Hello and welcome to The Rest Is History. Tom, this is a club bonus episode unlike any other.
We are sitting on the train from Amsterdam to Paris, so we are currently rolling through the Dutch countryside.
Yeah, we're heading towards Rotterdam now, Tom. Very exciting.
We've just come out of Schiphol, which of course is famous for the airport.
Yeah.
And Dominic, there is an interesting etymological debate about the origin of Schiphol.
Really?
So I read that Schiphol was named after a whirlpool that existed in a sea that was over the site of the airport, and that it was a ship hole. So ships would be sucked down and destroyed. And I thought that sounds simultaneously so interesting and so implausible that I'll check it. And it turns out that this isn't actually the case, apparently.
Brilliant story.
Great shame.
Great story.
But isn't that one of the frustrations of doing historical research, where you come across a story that seems so brilliant and you kind of think, I probably should check that. If I check it,
I probably
won't then be able to say it.
I suppose so. Like Cardinal, like George Brown dancing with the Cardinal Archbishop of Lima. That's not true. Yes. So we're on the train. I think that story was slightly oversold because you said it was a really interesting story.
It is an interesting story. I mean, because it might be true. I'm not an expert on Dutch etymology, so it might be true.
Well,
I mean, who knows? It certainly has been debated.
No one can accuse us on this podcast of ducking the big subjects. So, Tom, we're on the train.
Oh, we've just passed some cows sitting by a canal.
Heading through the Low Countries. And the reason for that is we have just recorded two episodes on location in Amsterdam, which is one of your favourite cities.
It is. And do you know, infuriatingly, just as we were leaving, I got forwarded an email from my publisher with an offer from the mayor of Amsterdam.
Theo is laughing in the background at the rank and unashamed boasting that...
it's not a boast, Dominic.
Yeah.
I think it bodes
name
well for...
Name-dropping of
I think
the
it
worst
bodes
kind.
Well. I think
of
it bodes well
kind.
For...
You wouldn't get this
for any
me.
Future episodes that we do in Amsterdam.
Great. Well, listen, we did two episodes in Amsterdam, and what we did was a little bit like the episode that we did for the World Cup about the wonders of Poland, if you remember that. So what you did this time was we did two episodes and you have picked
eight spots
in Amsterdam that you think give a sense of give a flavor of the history of the city.
I mean, different to the Polish episode, to the degree that these were designed to give a chronological sense. So we go from the very beginnings of Amsterdam, which of course was a dam on the Amstel.
Yeah.
So we go to the spot where the dam was, which is Dam Square in the middle of the city. And it goes right the way up to the red light district, doesn't it, Dominic? Which
it does. And I was a bit ambivalent, as you know, Tom, about recording in the red light district. Because I thought I wanted to avoid...
As a governor of your local school, you didn't want to be seen coming out of...
As a school governor, I thought it was poor. but also I thought we should avoid any sort of hint of the stag do about this recording session, which we did. Although I will say, for the very last location, so we had two producers with us, Theo and Alex. Theo, Alex, and I, you dragged us to this alley. Then three of us looked round and were like, oh, Tom, we're not doing it here. Oh, for God's sake. As we saw what was going on in the windows behind us. And you were like, what's wrong with you? Why?
Well, because just to explain, the point was to contrast because the red light district in Amsterdam is in the ancient medieval city.
Yeah.
So I wanted a spot with an obviously medieval and indeed hopefully Christian connotation.
Yeah.
Next to all the scenes for which the red light district in Amsterdam is notorious, and I found this one that was Grey Monk's Cloister.
Grey Monk's Cloister, yeah.
And it was surrounded by the kind of scenes that, Boccaccio or Chaucer, it's exactly the kind of thing you'd expect to see in a monastery.
Clearly there are some establishments in Amsterdam, if you go in and you ask for a Grey Monk's Cloister, precisely what. Well, anyway, the three of us persuaded you to go around the corner, which was mildly more salubrious.
Well, we were kind of recording it opposite a sex shop, weren't we, with
it
all kinds of exotic adverts. But just to say the reason for doing that was to discuss the emergence of liberalism, kind of pot, coffee shops, ladies in bare windows, all that kind of thing. In the context of the Second World War.
Well, it's not just that, but also in the context of Amsterdam's history as a place, you know, the Dutch Republic, Calvinism, the sort of the physical embodiment of Protestant sobriety, and yet at the same time, this bastion of liberal tolerance where anything goes.
And I think we must be going under the Rhine, do you think? I think we're approaching Rotterdam, where we've gone into a tunnel.
We've gone into a massive tunnel, yeah. So if there's a great roaring you can hear, that's why. Yeah, because basically we're going past The Hague now, Tom.
Right. I read a brilliant account of the frustrations of the director of the Rijksmuseum. You know, the Rijksmuseum was shut for a long time, many years.
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah.
They were doing a huge refurbishment of it. And he was complaining that all you had to do was dig even a tiny hole and it filled with water. Because,
right,
of course,
yeah,
Amsterdam is absolutely built on water, and I guess much of the Netherlands is.
Yes, of course.
I don't know if you went to the Rijksmuseum when it was shut for this refurbishment. Basically, they put all the greatest hits in one room.
They did. They did.
That was wonderful.
I remember that very well. So the first time I went to Amsterdam, it was shut, and they had one room, and they basically put all the good stuff in one room. More museums and art galleries should do that, Tom. I'm a great believer in the small gallery, so I was telling you,
we've just
earlier,
come out now. We've come out of the. This is live commentary of a trip through the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And we're looking out, and would you know it, it's flat.
The Mauritshuis in The Hague.
Yes.
Beautiful gallery where they have the girl with the pearl earring. So I went this weekend to the Vermeer exhibition, which I know you've been to already.
Yes. And what did you think?
I thought the stuff is excellent, but there are far too many people. It's really, really hard to enjoy.
The noise, the people.
Yeah, well, come on. If you go to one of these blockbuster exhibitions.
Well, I told you how I negotiated this. I took my mother and borrowed a wheelchair.
Yes.
And just used her to kind of ram my way through. So I recommend that.
We're going to Paris because tomorrow morning we're going to be recording two more on-location episodes set in Paris in 1968.
Yes.
So we're doing the events of 1968 and Charles de Gaulle's famous flight from Paris
to the General Massu,
to the army base at Baden-Baden, where he clearly was thinking he would have to secure military support for a kind of Paris Commune style.
But it's debated, isn't it? Because there's also the theory that he was in a blind funk.
Yeah.
And contemplating, yeah, kind of grabbing his wife's jewels and things. And
well, the fact that he encourages his family to come with him suggests that he's considering fleeing into exile. But we'll discuss this in the podcast tomorrow. It's a fascinating story.
So we've done one episode on the French Revolution.
Yeah.
And we're doing two episodes on Les Événements.
On the failed revolution.
Revolution of 1968.
Yeah. Well, that's the way we roll, isn't it, on the rest
Well,
of
I think history. I think it's reflective of the way in which we are, in some of our episodes, increasingly going microscopic, going in deep.
We are, aren't we? I can see somebody coming around. A ticket collector might intervene at some future point. So our Rest is History listeners will really enjoy that, I'm sure. We're in the middle of releasing the island episodes, aren't we?
Yes. Oh. So,
bonjour.
Oh, hold on. This is live ticket collection. So very exciting. Theo is now speaking French.
So we're just about to have our ticket scanned. Sorry, this is absolutely
necessary.
Yeah, this is definitely what you listen to the podcast for.
Merci.
Well, yes. So as I was saying before we were shockingly interrupted, we're in the middle of releasing the island episodes.
Yes.
And so far, Tom, we haven't been cancelled.
Not yet.
So episode 2 has come out just today, Tom.
Yes.
And I think it's fair to say that Paul Rouse was one of our best ever guests, don't you think?
He was, and we've just gone back into a tunnel.
Yeah.
Yes, he really was. I mean, such a complex, sensitive subject in which there are such strongly held opinions across a wide range of perspectives. And I thought he was wonderful.
But I think that's because Paul holds measured, reasoned opinions very firmly. You know, he wasn't waffly and wishy-washy, as people tend to be. The other thing, Barry Grogan, one of our listeners, a great club stalwart of The Rest is History, pointed out that he's the only guest we've ever had who has managed his county in a GAA sport. So Paul, we didn't know this before.
GAA being
the Gaelic Athletic Association, I think. So Paul managed his county, Offaly, in football, Gaelic football.
Yeah, well, that is absolutely a first. I mean, we've never had that.
You know, if you Google him, you see him being interviewed at pitch side and, You know, he's a proper manager.
Of our other guests, who would you be most surprised to learn had been a referee in a...
A referee manager.
A Gaelic Athletic Association event.
A manager. Camilla Townsend.
Camilla Townsend.
Historian of the Aztecs.
I would be surprised.
Yes. I don't... Yes. Susanna Lipscomb? Yes, I mean, would she be managing like a hurling team or something? Unlikely, I'd have thought.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, so that is definitely a first.
Yeah. So,
but he also had very detailed knowledge of cricket.
Paul.
Yeah.
Paul knows loads about Irish cricket.
Yeah.
He's done like a massive podcast.
Very fitting because England are playing Ireland on Thursday.
But so in the middle of the Paul series, there's a guest appearance by
friend of the show, Dan Jackson.
Talking about his PhD, which is about on home rule, on the home rule debates in Britain, and how close we came to civil war. That is such an interesting subject, I think.
Yeah, because it's an absolute reminder of what I guess people in Britain are prone to assuming that, you know, Ireland is absolutely a part of British history, and that what happens in Ireland does have knock-on effects in Britain. And there's been a lot of discussion I've seen on the Discord about why people in Britain tend not to study it, why this history has been forgotten.
I have strong views on this, Tom.
I reckon one of the reasons is that the whole experience, the degree to which questions of Irish Home Rule and indeed independence got snarled up in the kind of the matrix of British politics was so traumatic that once that had been kind of cut out, nobody in British politics wanted to think about it anymore.
So here's my answer to that. I totally disagree with you.
Do you?
I genuinely don't think for most people it was traumatic because I don't think they cared.
No, but the political classes.
The political classes.
The political classes.
But don't forget they cared about Ulster. They didn't care about Ireland. I think that is a big difference. So once they'd kept Ulster, I mean, for the Tories, Ulster became a kind of shibboleth, didn't it? It became a symbol of the empire and of the integrity of the sort of British world. And once they knew that Ulster was satisfied, then I think they didn't care about Westmeath or anything.
I don't think that the Liberals really cared about Ulster either. I mean, the Tories may have done, and they did so in part, I'm sure, because they passionately, so Bone Law, we'll talk about this.
Yeah.
Was of Scottish and Ulster Presbyterian stock.
He definitely cared.
So
he was
really,
about
really
it.
Cared to a degree that I think some of our listeners will find pretty shocking. But I don't think the Liberals particularly cared. I think that...
Just to explain, we're now arriving in Rotterdam.
We're arriving into Rotterdam. Yeah. I think that Asquith, Lloyd George, Churchill, I don't think they really cared very much about Ulster.
No, we know that with the Ronan Fanning book makes this very clear that we talk about a lot of fatal path. That makes it clear that actually the Liberals who, with the exception of Gladstone, most liberal politicians who wanted to give home rule to Ireland actually didn't really care about it.
But I think that emerging out of the First World War, that was the great trauma.
Yeah.
That was the great focus of effort. I think people in London thought, but we can't really be bothered with this. I think that was part what determined the response to the Easter Rising and then to the War of Independence. And I think that once they had, as they saw it, extracted themselves from the Irish question.
I agree with that. We're going to pause for a second just while people get on and off the train. Tom, what's your lead? Back to answer some questions in a few moments. So we're back after that short intermission where people got on and off the train.
We're still in Rotterdam.
We're still in Rotterdam now.
Doors are open.
I agree with you that Lloyd George in the early 1920s basically couldn't really give a damn about Ireland, so he didn't want to commit more men, more resources. The British Empire is hugely overstretched in the early 1920s anyway. I don't think that's why people lost interest in Ireland, and nor do I think that's why people don't remember it and they don't really teach it in schools and all of that kind of stuff in Britain. I think the reasons for it are very mundane. I don't think most people in Britain ever cared about Ireland or were particularly interested in it. I think it didn't have and doesn't have. Now, our Irish listeners may be aggrieved at this, but I think to most British punters, it doesn't have the glamour that, let's say, French history or Italian history might have. In schools, I think people's attitude is that it's very complicated, it is difficult, it's controversial, so teachers don't necessarily want to touch it. But I don't think it's a deliberate omission. I mean, I don't think it's as though what people are... I mean, the claim is always made. This is a bit sort of... I always think there's a danger here of turning into Satnam Sangira and saying, the doors are about to close, by the way. That's what you can hear.
There we go.
And now they have closed.
And now they're shut.
So I think there's a danger here of turning into Satnam Sangira and saying, oh, all British schools should teach my own hobby horse. And if they don't, the explanation must be ignorance or malevolence. I think basically schools have really difficult choices. And for people who are interested in Anglo-Irish relations, as you and I are, Tom, we think, oh, they should do it. But I mean, I think...
Well, I'm not saying that at all, actually. I would never be prescriptive about what people should study at school.
Good.
I think, no, I'm not remotely prescriptive, but I do think that, I mean, obviously, this story matters incredibly to people in Ireland.
It's
the foundational story of the Irish state.
But it doesn't matter to most people in Britain.
But exactly, it doesn't matter. But there was a period, you know, there have been long periods of history where it has mattered.
Yeah.
So it matters in the late 16th and 17th century. It matters in the late 19th, early 20th century, basically up to 1914.
Yeah.
It does matter. And it's kind of, it's summed up as being the Irish question.
British question.
It's never the British question. It's always the Irish question.
Yeah.
And once the Irish question has been solved by basically saying, okay, we're out. We'll keep Ulster. You can keep the rest.
Yeah.
Then people just want to forget about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the... Well, next year...
But Britain can afford to forget about it.
Of course.
Because it doesn't impinge.
Of course.
And actually, the only time really that it's impinged was during the Troubles, of course.
Well, that was a result...
And recently during Brexit.
The Troubles were, and to some degree... a result of forgetting about it, because Britain's... I mean, I was reading something about this the other day, that Britain, from the middle... in fact, the early 1920s onwards, the British government didn't want to look at Ulster, didn't want to look at what was happening, didn't want to look at the fact that, you know, there were massive imbalances in Northern Ireland, because all they cared about was stability. And as it were, as you said, solving the question. But all that actually did in the long run was to kick
build
the question.
Up more questions.
Yeah, to kick more questions down the road, which would come back 40 years later. Anyway.
But I think basically the answer is you can tell the history of Britain without reference to Ireland, but you can't really tell the history of Ireland without reference to Britain.
Yes. Now, some listeners will say, but you shouldn't tell the history of Britain without reference to Ireland. And that's fine. But I mean, you shouldn't tell the history of Britain without reference to France or indeed the Netherlands, as we've discussed in Amsterdam, or India, or any of these places. I think the trouble is, you know, you can make a case for so many things being essential.
I think Ireland is an exceptional... because Ireland was part of the United Kingdom. So Ireland was a constituent part of the country in which we live in. I mean, that would be the argument, and I think that it is a valid one.
Yeah.
But I'm still not saying that... I still don't want to be prescriptive.
Okay, now, Theo is very keen that we get into some of these questions that people have been posting on the Discord, because in a new and exciting innovation on our Rest is History bonus episodes, we've got doors opening and closing all around us, so if you're worried that's what you're hearing, that's what you're hearing. We are asking you to submit questions, because particularly over the summer, we'll be trying to get through as many of your questions as we can. Now, we're going to try and do this quite quick fire, aren't we, Tom? Because we know that we only have a short window of time before the conductor comes around again and there's more hullabaloo with tickets.
So we're going to do this very rapidly.
Yes.
Okay, so this is King's Thursday. Are there any countries you have not yet visited that you would like to visit, and why? Additionally, any monuments or buildings you would still hope to visit? Dominic?
I'd like to go to Peru and visit Machu Picchu. I would like to go to... you've been to Iran.
Yeah.
And I have not been to Iran. I would like to see some of the magnificent sites in Iran. Do you know what? I've never been to Egypt.
Oh, wow.
So well, I would very much like to go to Egypt and see Luxor, the Valley of the Kings,
pyramids.
All that carry on. The pyramids?
No.
I hear bad reports of the pyramids.
No, they're massive. They're pyramids.
Not good, Tom?
No, they're amazing.
Are they?
They're amazing. So I would very much like to visit Japan. Been on my hit list. I would also very much like to see Machu Picchu, and I would like to see Angkor Wat.
Angkor Wat.
Okay.
Okay. So, Nimlin, this is one for you, Tom, because after the podcast about Athens and the birth of democracy, American leaders like to call the United States the world's oldest democracy. Is it? How would you define the question? And what nation do you think deserves the title? And why is the answer Great Britain?
The world's oldest democracy is Athens. I mean, clearly, we've discussed that.
That's a different kind of democracy from what we consider.
Doesn't matter. It's still the world's oldest democracy.
What's the world's oldest democracy in terms that we would understand today?
Well, our understanding of democracy is constantly evolving.
Oh, Tom, what an evasive answer.
Well, I've given you the answer. The world's oldest democracy is Athens.
The answer is the Isle of Man, isn't it? Or somewhere like that.
The thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the thing.
All right.
They had things. Vikings.
They are so panicked about train official interference. He's telling us to hurry up, even though I think we're speaking quite
quickly.
Okay.
So, top vicar, if Tom and Dom had to live in another country and devote the rest of their career to studying the history of that country, where would they choose? We'll give them enough money to be comfortable and safe, but they can't choose America, Italy, or Greece. I would choose France.
Ooh, I would choose... now, I do like Sweden, as you know, Tom. I love Sweden. But the thought of doing Swedish history... Well, I'd do the Great North... So, this would be... I would move to
and
Sweden.
And you do Vikings.
And I'd do a series of podcasts about the Great Northern War, as is so often being requested by our Scandinavian listeners. So I would do that. But I would also have a summer home... No, a winter home in Croatia.
I don't think that's allowed. I think you're changing the frames of the...
No. That's my answer, but it's involving seasonal alternative place.
And lastly, Jesse B., what historic figure, whom existed before photography existed, would you most like to see a picture or film reel of? I think I know Tom's answer, but still curious. Yes, that's exactly...
Is it Jesus, Tom?
Yeah, of course. I'd like to see if he looked like the Turin Shroud.
I mean, I was going to say, would you like to see Muhammad? But I mean, is that a dodgy question? Sure, you're allowed to look at Muhammad. I mean, you can't.
Yeah, I think you're allowed to. That's a very interesting theological question. Yeah, imagine putting that on YouTube. The internet would melt.
I think is there some drinking game that will now get points if I say Oliver Cromwell? I mean, surely there is.
Oliver Cromwell. But you know what Cromwell looks like?
But I haven't seen seen moving pictures.
But wouldn't you like to see someone who is. I mean, there's no visual portrayal of him at all.
Okay, hold on, let me think.
I would say that the person who's been most portrayed visually, who we have no idea what he looked like, is Jesus. Don't you think?
But would you not be worried about being disappointed?
I wouldn't be disappointed.
You've built him up in your mind.
And, built him up in my mind.
So, on Jesus, now this is the note on which to close.
It would be hilarious if he was blonde.
Jesus
looked like Prince Albert.
There's going to be a new film, Tom, about the life of Jesus, directed by Martin Scorsese.
Possibly starring Tom Holland.
Starring... Hollywood's Tom Holland. How do you feel about that?
I feel gutted.
So that when people Google Tom Holland Christianity,
Jesus, Tom Holland, not that I've ever
the
done
real
that.
Tom Holland will come up first time. Brilliant.
Terrible. Yeah.
All right. So I can see the train officials coming. On that note, Tom, we should stop recording, stop talking before we get into trouble. We should go to Paris, do our episodes on Paris.
Come back.
And then we're going to the United States. How exciting.
Yeah. Go to Washington, go to New York.
Because we've got our live shows next week in Washington and New York.
And we're recording some episodes there, aren't we, on Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech.
And New York in the 70s.
New York in the 70s.
Right, so, jolly good.
Lots to look forward to.
We will thank you for all your questions, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.